supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And Gottlieb, thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today, we're talking about feedback. Well, thanks to Steppenwolf, there's that kind of feedback that most of us enjoy. Or when someone pays us a compliment, we enjoy that. But just like Steppenwolf's feedback, it can be jarring, unexpected, hurtful, annoying. So why is it so hard to hear criticism? And how can we use negative criticism even when it's not 100% accurate? Well, this is the topic of a new book by Harvard Law professors Doug Stone and Sheila Heen. It's called Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. Sheila Heen is our guest on today's show. Over the last 20 years, she's been working with the Harvard Negotiation Project to develop the theory and practice of negotiation. Her previous book with Douglas Stone, Difficult Conversations, it was a major bestseller, which has been named one of the top 75 Penguin classics of all time. Sheila, welcome back to the show.
Well, I'm so pleased to be here, Dan.
Well, I have to tell you, the reason your book became a bestseller is exclusively because of the number of books I have bought and given out to my patients. I just ordered another 10 copies.
And fantastic.
I give them out to almost all my patients. And as a matter of fact, a colleague of mine, Dr. Michael Baim, who runs the Penn Program for Mindfulness, has taught mindfulness courses based on your book. So,
well, you know, that's been one of the fun things over the last 15 years, which is learning how people all over the world in all different walks of life are using it in ways that we never even imagined.
Yeah.
So that's actually been enormously both gratifying, and we have continued to learn then from other people, right, who are taking the work to the next level.
Yeah, that's always the case, isn't it? Anyway, let's talk about your new book, Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback. I have a feeling we're going to get lots of calls today, so please call early. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What do you do with feedback when it is not what you expected, when it's more critical? And not only that, some people have difficulty accepting positive feedback. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. So let's back up and talk about the whole concept of feedback. We know that a report card, a performance review, obviously, is feedback. But what about our internal feedback, that critical judge that is relentless and never, ever pays us compliment? Is that a form of feedback?
Well, you bet. And one of the things that I want to be clear about is that we're not just talking about performance reviews. You know, in fact, all of us swim in an ocean of feedback every single day. It's the comments that you have for yourself about how you're handling things at the moment. It's the regrets that we feel, but it's also both spoken and unspoken feedback, right? It's what gets thanked or what gets dropped. It's, you know, being invited back or suddenly not. And so I think we're getting it from all sides, from our kids, from our family members and friends, as well as at work, from customers, clients, and coworkers.
Well, you said in your book that organizations spend billions of dollars each year to train supervisors, managers, how to give feedback more effectively. But you said, although this can be helpful, the more important issue is on the receiver side. how we learn to take feedback. Why shift that?
Well, what's interesting is that as we worked with people around the world on six different continents on their most difficult conversations in the last 15 years, feedback is on that list of some of the conversations they're struggling with the most. And it's on the list 100% of the time. It doesn't matter what industry they're in. It doesn't matter who they are or why we're there to help them. And I've yet to meet an organization that feels like it's got this performance feedback thing right, whether that means the evaluation or appraisal system or the coaching system. And you're right that the typical approach is to get all the managers together and teach them how to give more skillfully and more persistently. And, you know, we do that work. It is helpful. Everybody benefits when leaders have better communication skills. But what eventually occurred to us was that at the end of the day, it kind of doesn't matter how much power or authority or skill or even persistence that the giver's got. It's the receiver who's in charge of what they let in, what sense they're making of it, and whether and how they choose to change. And so it suddenly occurred to us that we were going about this entirely backwards, that the real leverage is in teaching us all to become better receivers. It's almost going from a push model of learning, like I'll decide what you need to learn and I'll try to get you to learn it, to a pull model of learning, where we actually can take charge and accelerate our own learning and get something valuable out of even the most poorly delivered, unfair feedback.
All right, so let's go back now to the critical judge. There are many of my colleagues who devote a great deal of time and energy to annihilating that little thing, or at least cutting out its vocal cords, because that critical judge is rarely accurate and always mean-spirited and relentless. So are you telling us we should listen?
Well, you know, you're pointing out something that I think is interesting, which is that I think feedback can be particularly challenging for high achievers, partly because we have such high standards for ourselves. And as human beings, we're just not going to meet those standards 100% of the time. It's not a realistic expectation. And sometimes we use up all of our energy trying to meet those standards at work. By the time we get home to our family, we're exhausted, right? So we have almost nothing left to try to be the kind of people we know we want to be with them. And I think that this ties into something that we talk about in the book, which is building on the work done by Carol Dweck out at Stanford, trying to move from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset.
For example?
You know, fixed minds. Have you guys talked about this on the program before?
No. But we're about to.
We're about to. Carol Dweck has done some fascinating work looking at the way that we hold what I would call our identity, the story we tell about who we are. And she finds that about half of us have what's called a fixed mindset. In a fixed mindset, I am who I am. You know, I'm smart or I'm not, I'm capable or I'm not, I'm responsible or I'm not. And so any feedback about ourselves, whether that comes from outside or, of course, because we know better, inside, mm-hmm. Is devastating because it's a verdict. I suddenly find out I'm not smart. She discovered this actually by giving kids puzzles, and the puzzles got increasingly difficult. And as the puzzles got increasingly difficult, as we would expect, many kids gave up. It's almost as if they heard the puzzle whispering to them, or maybe it's their little internal critic starting to whisper, "You're not smart enough for this." And so they would give up in embarrassment or frustration. But some kids actually didn't give up. Some kids actually got more excited the harder the puzzles got, even though they weren't solving them. And at first she thought there was something wrong with them. What's wrong with these kids? Don't they realize they're failing? And what she eventually realized is they didn't think that they were failing. They thought that they were learning. And they had what she calls a growth mindset, which says, well, I am however I am right now. Hard work and effort pay off, and the kind of thing I need to get better is actually something that challenges me. And I think those of us with a fixed mindset are the ones that have the harshest inner critic, because we know that we're not always, you know, smart or responsible, because it's just not human. If you can move to a growth mindset, well, then feedback is actually very helpful to you, because it tells you where you stand and what you need to learn next.
So how, Professor Heaton, how do we shift from those two mindsets?
Oh, it's impossible.
Ah. Oh, God, you sound like me. Oh, no.
Well, if you have a
so are you telling are you,
you know,
telling
effort
me
isn't going to matter.
Are you telling me your mindset on this is fixed?
No, but I am saying that that's one of the funny things about moving from a fixed to a growth mindset. It's exactly in a fixed mindset that it feels like it's impossible, right? But in fact, it's not impossible. And we talk about three practices that can help you shift your the way that you hold who you are from fixed to growth. So, for instance, one of them is what we call sorting for coaching. And I should back up and just say, when we talk about feedback, that term is very vague. It actually is used to mean three very different things. The first is appreciation. Appreciation just says, I see you, I get you, you matter. You know, with kids, you see this right on the surface, like, mom, look. But, you know, we never really outgrow it. And it's what keeps people motivated. The second is coaching, which is aimed to try to help you get better at something. And that's, of course, where a lot of learning can happen. The third is what we call an evaluation. It's an appraisal, an assessment. It tells you where you stand. It's your grade. It's your performance appraisal. It's the blue ribbon for your cherry pie. It's evaluation that is most emotionally loud that makes us feel judged, and it can drown out the other two. So when you're trying to move from fixed to growth, when we say sort for coaching, what that means is listen to even evaluation to try to hear what is this trying to tell me that I need to work on next. So, for instance, this has totally changed, by the way that I parent. My sixth grader came home with his report card, and instead of sitting down to look at the grades, you know, how did you do, is that good or bad, we actually sat down and said, okay, first of all, let's just look at what is there to appreciate here. You know, you brought this up, you worked hard at this, I know you've been putting a lot of effort here. Then we take a look at, okay, where are the grades that suggest that there's something you need to work on? You know, let's look at your math grade. What does this suggest you need to do differently if you want to pull this up? And then the conversation we have is about the coaching that he can hear embedded in the evaluation or the grade.
Hmm. We're talking with Sheila Heen about feedback, the whole phenomenon of feedback, and why it's so difficult for us to receive, especially negative feedback. Give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499 if you have difficulty receiving feedback, positive or negative. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Fred, let's go to the phones. We've got Charles on the line. Hi, Charles.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Appreciate it. Enjoying the show.
Sure, me too.
Well, first of all, I have to tell you that I start with the premise that people really don't want to hear advice or feedback a lot of the time, not all the time. And my question is about starting the advice or starting the process of a conversation where you're going to maybe give a colleague or a friend a perception about them or an opinion that maybe they're not going to be terribly receptive to, but starting it with something positive, focusing on something positive that's happening or is working, and then getting to the critical part. When I've done that in the past, I've had other colleagues and other people kind of criticize me a little bit and say, well, you know, you should just be direct and tell them directly what you're going to say. Don't soften them up is what, you know, how they sometimes put it. And I just wanted to get your comments on that and see what you think about, you know, starting a conversation where you know there's going to be some difficult topics with something positive.
Okay. Thanks so much for the call. Sheila's going to address that. And I've got a follow-up question to that. Sheila, go on.
Okay. So are you going to say something positive to me first, I hope, and then give me the hard question?
Hell no.
I mean, Charles's comment is and question is a really common one, because the idea is, well, if I give them something positive first, then they'll hear it as balanced when I then add something negative. And it's well intended, but particularly if it's not genuine or particularly relevant in the moment, it often will actually backfire because it functions as basically easing into the real message, which is the second part of the question. I say when it's not particularly relevant because sometimes, you know, you sit down and talk about how did that presentation go, and you do actually have relevant, positive things to say. Other times, you're just searching for something positive to say because in order to get to the real message. And how it's received is all linked into what we call the challenge of being me. There are three challenges to feedback: the challenge to see, the challenge of we, and the challenge of being me. And part of the challenge of being me is fixed growth mindset, but part of it is also just the way that we're wired. And if you look at people's sensitivity to feedback, meaning how far do they swing emotionally in the wake of a negative piece of feedback or a positive piece of feedback, and how long does it take them to recover, individuals can vary by up to 3,000%.
Sure.
And that is has profound implications for us individually for just understanding our own footprint, but it also has implications for how givers and receivers interact. Because if I am relatively insensitive or even keel, then I genuinely don't understand why you're reacting so badly to what I think is a, you know, medium-sized or even small-sized suggestion for you. And, of course, then I give you the feedback that you shouldn't take it so personally, which just compounds the problem because now I'm giving you negative feedback about how you take feedback. So Charles's question, I think, actually brings us around to something that's at the heart of it, which is the receiver is actually the one who knows how they will best hear and learn from something you have to offer them.
How?
And so,
how do they know that?
Simply having them, having a conversation about how do you receive feedback and what do you find helpful. So the sensitivity variation, for instance, has led my co-author Doug and I, who have very different profiles, to put our finger on something that had been sort of unspoken between us in the past, which is he's quite sensitive, and he actually doesn't want me to, you know, during a break in a presentation, to make a suggestion because it will upset him so much that it will throw him off for the rest of the presentation. So it actually makes it worse. Whereas I have the opposite preference. If there's something I could improve, please tell me in the middle when I have the chance to actually fix it. If you tell me at the end, I'm going to be frustrated that you waited until it was too late.
Which is
and
why
so it's the receiver who actually is able to say, hey, this will actually be helpful to me, and that actually won't.
Well, that sets up my follow-up question. And you know, one of the questions was telling a colleague or a friend, and My mantra is that unsolicited advice is usually self-serving. That if nobody's, say, a friend, I mean, if it's part of your job description, okay. But, you know, if you're hanging out with a friend, you know, and you give them advice about what they could do or should do, that's usually about the advice giver's discomfort.
With whatever is happening.
Yeah.
You mean? Yeah.
I mean, one of the examples in your book was, I think about a woman who criticized her husband's behavior at a bar mitzvah, or vice versa.
Yeah, vice versa. Yes.
Yeah, but it was about really his discomfort in there, as much as her behavior, if not more so.
Yeah. So there are a couple of things packed into what you're describing. One is that we can have all kinds of reactions, and you would think there'd be a million different kinds of reactions that we can have, but actually there are three different kinds of reactions. You can kind of group them into three buckets. One is this challenge to see ourselves, or to see what the giver's even talking about. But the second one that's really implicated here is the challenge of we, that we can have reactions to who is giving us the feedback and how, when, or why they might be giving us the feedback. And sometimes our reaction to the who is bigger than the what the feedback is. In other words, your advice might be good, but I was unaware I cared about your opinion on this front.
Yeah.
And that in relationships, in terms of coaching, there are really two kinds of coaching. One is, I'm going to help you get better at something, like play tennis or balance your checkbook. But the other is what we call relationship coaching. And my relationship coaching for you is not motivated by, oh, wouldn't it be great if you got better at this? It'd be good for you to get better at it. It's actually motivated by something you're doing that's hurting me. And so because it's hurting me, I want you to change, because then it won't be upsetting me anymore. And so you're right, I think, that often the coaching that happens inside relationships has as much to do with what's upsetting the giver as whatever the receiver is doing
and
to provoke it.
And that, too, should be respected, that here's something that's troubling me. Is this my responsibility to do something about it? Yes, but is there a way you can help me here feel less discomfort, less shame? And it's a relationship.
Yeah, I think that's right. So one of our chapters is on relationship systems where differences between us are causing friction. And, of course, as a result, I think you should change. You, of course, know that I'm the real problem. And so sorting out, okay, what does this feedback mean and who would need to change what, will actually allow you to have a better quality conversation between you. Rather than, I think often what happens is we're so upset by something that comes unsolicited or unexpected that we sort of dismiss it and feel, I don't know, hurt or betrayed that the person would even mention it. Or we don't even think of it as feedback because it's just our spouse's chronic complaints about who we are.
I've been hugging you. We've got lots of callers who want to join the conversation. Let's get one more caller in before we have to take a break. We've got Susan on the line. Hey, Susan.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'll just go right into it. My mother criticized me every day of my life that she was alive. She didn't die until I was in my late 50s. I have a terrible time with criticism. I expect criticism. I've learned not to criticize my children. I don't do so well with my husband. But is it surprising that I overreact to criticism based on what I grew up with?
Sheila?
Oh, Susan, I'm so sorry to hear that. And really what you're describing is one of the reasons why we included Chapter 10 of the book, which is when boundaries are needed. Because becoming a better feedback receiver, I think, sometimes means, and certainly in the situation that you describe, means actually putting up some boundaries to protect yourself, knowing when you need to shut down the relentless criticism because it's really undermining your sense of self. And I really want to commend you. And so that chapter talks about how do you know if a boundary may be needed and how do you put it into place. I really want to commend you for working hard not to pass that on to your kids. And so then the question is, in trying to withhold your feedback or criticism of them, and criticism, by the way, that word suggests judgment. It suggests evaluation, not necessarily coaching. And so I guess I would encourage you to keep the judgment out of the picture that you felt from your mom, but not to pass up opportunities to appreciate things that they're doing well or to coach them and help them out along the way. And I don't know if in your experience that distinction exists given your history.
Susan, I think there's an awful lot of great guidance in the book, and I strongly urge you to read it. But let me ask you one quick question. How's your relationship with you, speaking of criticism?
I'm sorry, my relationship with...
Yourself, with Susan.
With myself.
Yeah, how's that working?
I've been self-employed for 30 years. I've had to learn to tell myself when to behave. And to give myself breaks as well.
Oh, you do. So you're.
I do.
So your critical judge is not beating you up, huh?
No.
Good.
No.
Okay.
It's just I'm susceptible to criticism when it comes at me, and I'm surprised.
On the outside, sure. Well,
yes.
You know, you're well on your way here, because if you can be kind to yourself, all the research shows that you are much more likely to be kind to others. So there's some feedback there for you. Susan, thanks so much for your call. We are going to have to take a short break. We are talking about feedback today with Sheila Heen. Her most recent book is called The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. Well, thanks for the feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. Our number is 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines open, so please call us earlier rather than later. Tell us your feelings about feedback, your experience of it, receiving it, positive or negative. Again, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Penn Program for Mindfulness provides tools for coping, personal growth, and transformation. 8-week foundation courses combine mindfulness techniques with cognitive science to help teach participants to change the way they experience the world. Participants will learn how mindfulness is used to manage life's biggest challenges. Courses begin in September, January, and April. More at pennmedicine.org/mindfulness or 215-615-2774. On May 30th and 31st, the program will host renowned mindfulness teacher Sharon Salzberg.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. We are speaking with Sheila Heen about feedback. Our number is 888-477-9499. Sheila, we're talking about the receiver and different people on a continuum of how they receive feedback. And, you know, it could even vary day by day. For example, say my girlfriend says goodbye to me in the morning and I hear a tone in her voice that sounds different. I take that tone as feedback and I spend the rest of the day obsessing if she is angry at me. Is her tone a form of feedback, or does it simply indicate that I might be a quart low on serotonin that day?
That's a great question. Well, and it points out that how you feel influences what you think, and also what you think influences how you feel. So one of the important effects, if you swing wide emotionally in the wake of feedback or you're having a bad day, it can actually distort the feedback itself. So the tone that your girlfriend used can grow to be, well, she must always be mad at me, and this is just where it's first leaking out, and she must, you know, have been upset with me for a long time, and probably maybe the relationship hasn't been working for a long time, and certainly before lunch she's going to break up with me. The same happens with feedback, right? Getting feedback that your presentation, one of the slides could have been more clear, becomes, I can't do anything right. And we fall into what we have dubbed the Google bias, because it's mentally and emotionally as if you Google everything that's wrong with me. And all your past mistakes and bad judgments come rushing to the fore, and suddenly you can't do anything right. You get 1.2 million hits, right? And there are sponsored ads from your father and your ex. But it's a bias because your results are driven by your search term. You didn't Google things that are going reasonably well, or things I'm handling reasonably well, or things that are going well with my girlfriend, which might give you a more balanced perspective.
But it's not just what we Google. It's also about brain anatomy. You know, we had cognitive neuroscientist Rick Hansen on discussing his book, Hardwiring Happiness. And he said our brains are like Velcro for negative feedback and Teflon for positive feedback.
Well, that's exactly right. And it is wiring. It's one of the reasons why some people are also more sensitive than others, and that when you're down, it not only turns up the volume on negative feedback, but it also muffles positive feedback. But he's exactly right, of course, that we have a sort of threat alert system for negative feedback that sort of is hardwired directly to your soul, whereas positive feedback doesn't have the same kind of hardwired alert system. So it's almost never as strong as negative feedback.
I think you said something very important early in the book, that we are hardwired to learn and learn about ourselves, but we also want to be accepted for who we are. And I think that's the basic human dialectic between wanting to be unique and wanting to be a part of.
Well, I think it's also why we feel so conflicted about feedback, because it really does sit right at the juncture of those core human needs, the desire to learn and grow, which all the happiness research shows is a core piece of satisfaction in life. It's why we take up hobbies in retirement, right? And why we're addicted to all those phone games, because it's really fun to improve your score. But we also very deeply want to be accepted and respected the way we are now, and just the fact of feedback suggests that how you are now is not quite okay. So we have this conflicted relationship with feedback because looking back, we can see how something someone said to us or coached us to handle differently has made a huge impact, and we're very grateful. But at the same time, there are other situations where it's incredibly painful and destructive because it sits right at that intersection.
So you said that that's why we're all addicted to phone games, and now I'm hearing a woman who I consider brilliant and thoughtful using the word we, and I'm not addicted to phone games, and I wonder what's wrong with me, and there's shame that comes up.
So sorry, I was only speaking for myself and my own addiction to word puzzle games,
but
improving my score.
But there's a serious part of that. I feel shame, right.
Yeah, there's a serious part of it, but it's one of the reasons why games that have a score component, whatever they are addicting, because the game designers actually create them so that you go back and forth between reward, doing things that you've already mastered, and challenge, doing things that you're not quite good at yet, but that you can work at, which is also the way that we learn in life, right, is doing things that we're good at, which gives us satisfaction, but also we need the challenge to actually get better at something. And for people with a fixed mindset, the challenge is threatening, because we might fail. People with a growth mindset, the challenge is more welcome because it also holds opportunity.
If you're just joining the conversation, we're talking with Sheila Heen, author of Thanks for the Feedback. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We've got Farman on the line. Robert, I'm sorry. We have Robert on.
Yes.
Hi, Robert.
Yes, good afternoon. I just got off the commuter train and turned on the radio, and I couldn't believe the subject. It's home so hard. I was 32 years in the service, and it seemed like no matter what my rank was, I always had somebody senior to me who felt it was obligated to give me feedback. Sometimes it hurt, sometimes it didn't, but I found that if I respected the person and felt that they had more knowledge on the subject than I did, then I accepted it. But if it was the opposite, I just let it go and off my back like proverbial duck. I'll take my answer off the air, okay?
So, Sheila, Robert's talking about relationship, right?
He is, yeah. He's talking about that challenge of we, that our reaction to who is giving us the feedback is often even bigger than the usefulness or, you know, foolishness of what they're saying. And that our reaction to the who overshadows the what. So we have some people who are sort of pre-qualified. We admire them and we respect them and we're very eager for their feedback. And others who we've pre-disqualified their feedback. Now, the challenge here is that actually people you don't like or respect sometimes actually have good coaching for you. And there's a funny phenomenon where people you have difficulty working with, where you have some friction, are actually in a really valuable place to give you coaching. The people that you go to regularly who you like and who like you often don't see your edges, right, because you work more easily together. But the people you struggle to work with actually see your edges because they're so good at provoking them. And so going to someone you have trouble with to say, hey, you know, what's one thing you see me doing or maybe that I'm failing to do, where I'm getting in my own way or where I'm making it harder for us to work together? They actually have a valuable answer for you. And besides, if we wait around for all the perfect givers to show up, we're going to be waiting for a very long time. I mean, cherish the ones you have, but there are going to be whole eras of your work life or your home life where those perfect givers are not showing up. And so we're going to have to learn from imperfect givers as well if we really want to take charge and accelerate our own learning.
So that I'm going to learn better if I surround myself with annoying people.
Well, I wouldn't quite go that far. But the annoying people, the few of them, of course, and are you looking at them right now?
No.
Who surround us. They're the ones whose feedback often comes unsolicited, right? Or the criticisms are offhand. And learning how to deal with that better is actually going to make my life easier. If I can handle those interactions with less anxiety and more skill and maybe even turn them into something useful, boy, that's enormously valuable to me because a lot of those people aren't going away.
That's great advice. And so how do we learn to do that?
Well, one of the challenges that we haven't talked about yet is just the challenge to see. And that means both see what the giver means by their feedback, because they're often very vague, annoyingly unskilled and vague, but also the challenge to see ourselves accurately, because we all have blind spots. I mean, I'm tempted to say that I actually don't have blind spots, but I know everybody else does, because that's, of course, the nature of blind spots, is that we're not sure what they are. So in this chapter, we actually take a look at what are things that commonly fall into blind spots. And it's not just, you know, your own facial expressions or body language. It's also your tone of voice. So the comment from your girlfriend who maybe said goodbye to you this morning with a slight edge in her tone of voice, if you gave her feedback, well, that you were using that tone, she's not going to know what you were talking about.
Right.
And this has a neurological reason. There's a little part of our brain that is dedicated to listening to language when other people speak, and it decodes meaning, but it also decodes emotion embedded in tone. But when we ourselves speak, that part of our brain turns off.
Hmm.
And what this means is we don't listen to our own voice the way we listen to everybody else. It's why when we hear ourselves on a recording, we're so horrified at how we actually sound. Theoretically, we've heard our own voice every day of our lives, but actually we're not listening to it in the same way. And so when someone gives you feedback about tone of voice or even what you said, that actually falls in a blind spot because your internal voice is focused on what you are meaning. You're trying to figure out what to say. It's not actually listening to what you actually said,
you know,
or how you said it.
You know what? That's interesting to me because I find in my office people don't actually listen carefully to what they're saying, to the content of what they're saying. They don't actually hear it. It comes out kind of rote, and they're not really listening to it reflectively. And when I do that for them, it changes. It often changes a great deal. So I wonder if part of that, I'm just thinking theoretically, I just wonder if, you know, some part of that is the same operating system in the brain. Listen, we've got to take a break. We've got lots of callers who want to join the conversation. So we'll be back after 60 seconds. We're talking with Professor Sheila Heen. In addition to her work and her writing, she served with corporate clients, including Federal Reserve Bank, Singapore Supreme Court, and the Obama White House. Of course, her new book is called Thanks for the Feedback, and our phone number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
That was Jimi Hendrix. And no, we're not talking about that kind of feedback. The kind of feedback we are talking about is what our crack associate producer found when she went out on the street and asked some people what they thought about receiving feedback.
It depends on the context of the situation. If they offer constructive criticism, and especially I didn't ask for it, depending on my mood, I'll just smile and be like, thank you very much, you have a great day. And I'll take it into consideration.
I struggle with that.
With criticism?
Yeah, I do, a little bit. Well, criticism and advice, I would have to differentiate. Unsolicited advice is kind of stifling a lot.
I always like to assume the best intentions from people, so I wouldn't take it offensively.
It is an impulse that I find challenging sometimes, actually, because I hang out with a fair number of artists, and their training tends to be more about criticism, hopefully the most constructive possible way, right?
Sometimes I had to take an inventory of myself, you know, to look at what part I played in it. Sometimes criticism could be harmful, you know, but if you're friends of mine, then hurt my feelings, save my life.
So, Sheila, as you've been saying throughout the show, it really covers a range of how we take feedback, how we feel about it, what it means to us. It covers the range. Depends on the giver and the receiver.
Yeah, I think it does. And, you know, it's funny that up until now, almost all of the work on feedback has been on how to give feedback, given that it's such an interactive process and that we actually need other people to see our blind spots, but that learning about yourself isn't like learning about, you know, math or golf or how to tweet. Learning about yourself is a whole different ballgame because of blind spots and because of our own defensiveness.
You talked a good deal about empathy. And when you did, you talked about the work of Tanya Singer, who studied brains on empathy. And although empathy is readily available, excuse me, it was selective. Her subjects did not feel empathy for people they thought were treating someone unfairly. So tell us how the implications of that for the brain and the science of feedback.
Well, this is one of the most challenging things about receiving feedback, which is Tanya Singer, who started this work when she was at the University of Zurich, and now she's in London, found that people had a mirror neuron response when they watched a loved one or a friend getting an electric shock, right? And so their brain would light up as if they themselves had been shocked. So it's a mirror response because of the vicarious empathy that you feel for the person you see being hurt. But what she found is that if they were upset, mad at the person who was being shocked, or if they felt that they were acting unfairly, no mirror neuron response. In fact, in some cases, the pleasure center, so the revenge center, lit up. Now, let's take this into the context of receiving feedback. If I'm getting feedback from someone that feels unsolicited or unfair, or that I'm having a reaction to, then my feeling of being unfairly treated or upset with them is going to make it particularly challenging for me to ask the follow-up questions and get the curiosity that I need to actually understand the feedback that they're offering me. By the way, receiving feedback well doesn't mean you have to take the feedback. At the end of the day, you might just decide you disagree with it and leave it at the curb. But we decide that way too early because we feel like I have to decide right away, is this right or is it wrong? Is it true or untrue? If it's true, I have to worry about it. If it's not true, I can safely set it aside and move on. So we're really good at wrong spotting, at finding something that's wrong with the feedback, and we're really bad at actually having the curiosity about where it's coming from.
Yeah, I love that language you use in your book, wrong spotting. Let's go back to the phones. We got lots of people who want to join the conversation. We've got Mike on the line. Hi, Mike. We have Tom on the line.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
Hi, Tom.
I was a family physician for 30 years, and I found it nearly impossible to give women a compliment. Men would come in, and they were slovenly, unkempt, unshaven, and they would look in the mirror, and they'd say, I look pretty good, don't I, Doc? I said, you look like hell. And a woman would come in, and I'd say, you look pretty good today, you're working out. And she would say, no, my hair looks bad, my hips. It was impossible to give women a compliment. And as hard as I tried, it just didn't work.
So, Tom, did you read my interview? Because I was just going to talk about feedback in a larger context. Seriously, did you get to my interview before I read it? I'm wondering if you've got some cameras here. I'm feeling a little paranoid now. Let's do that. Let's get to the larger context here. So, gender differences in receiving feedback, even positive feedback. Tom, thanks for your call.
Well, everybody's now on the edge of their seat wanting to know whether men or women handle feedback better. And at least our research doesn't show a difference in gender in terms of responding to feedback. Now, Tom's experience, which is that the men that he would didn't even feel deserved the positive feedback, but gave it to themselves, and the women who came in, and when he would compliment them on their fitness or appearance, they would dismiss it, may also just be related to social mores. Like, I think when someone gives you a compliment, I think many of us feel a little uncomfortable, like we're not sure, we're not supposed to boast,
exactly.
Or we're not supposed to be proud, and so we sort of downplay it, and particularly, I think, for women around appearance, it's a sensitive subject that at least many often feel like, wait, where is this going? What are you trying to do? So that the motives of the giver, right, immediately come to the fore. Even if you trust that they're well-intentioned and it's nothing, it's an awkward moment socially, I think, between men and women.
Let's go to the phones. We got Mike on the line. Hey, Mike. Mike.
Dr. Dan.
Hi.
Hi. Love your show.
Thank you. Me too.
This may be a broad question, but, you know, in my long career, I've been involved or seen organizations that are just totally driven by negative feedback, and vice versa. I've seen organizations that, you know, are on a very positive bent with this. Is one more productive than the other, or is that too big a question?
That's a great question. Sheila, you've worked with large organizations. What's your experience? Thanks for the call, Mike.
Yeah, this is a great question. And by the way, on the heels of that last call about how men and women handle positive feedback, I loved your response to I Love Your Show, which was me too. which is a perfect response, because of course you enjoy doing it, right?
So
let's talk about Mike's question. You know, a Department of Labor study showed that 93% of Americans feel underappreciated at work. And of people who left their jobs, almost half cited being underappreciated as the primary reason that they left. Mm-hmm. And I think that in organizations, that lack of appreciation, which needs to be genuine, not just like, thank you for coming to work today, but where people feel noticed and valued for what they're doing and what they're contributing, is a key piece of keeping people motivated and keeping them focused and persistent on the challenges that come up every day in the workplace. Instead, performance appraisal systems focus only on the evaluation piece and maybe a little bit on the coaching piece, although it's really hard to hear the coaching at, you know, one meeting a year where you get a rating, because the rating, the evaluation is so loud, it often drowns out the coaching, right. And then appreciation gets dropped altogether.
I want to underscore two words you said just now. You said noticed and appreciated, and you said it in order, and I think it belongs right in that order, and I think that's more important than positive feedback. Is feeling noticed, feeling that you're seen for who you are. And once you have that experience, then I think you're more open to anything that comes down the pike.
I think that's exactly right, that if you feel noticed and if you feel that your efforts are seen, then you're also much more open to any coaching that someone has for you, right? I mean, sometimes when people say, gosh, I wish I got more feedback at work, what they mean is, I wish someone noticed that I work here. And I think that the same thing actually happens at home too. Like, I'm constantly coaching, correcting, nagging, etc. And I really have had to stop to say, look, part of what needs to happen is I need to just appreciate much more explicitly and more often all the things that they're going out of their way to do and do well. And that sort of lowers the temperature on all of the other coaching that, of course, comes with raising kids.
And just quickly, before we have to go, what about age and giving and receiving criticism? Personally, I'm finding it much easier. Like, there's less ego.
And also it's in context of the rest of your life. When you're a young professional starting out, that one critical piece of feedback, you know, it's like, 10% of your life experience at work. Whereas by the time you're your age and my age, you know, it's 0.1%, and we know that we can recover from it. But I think that one of the things maybe I'll end with here is that helping my kids develop the kind of identity that will help them, you know, respond well to a bad grade or a bad call in the ball game, and also make them more resilient to the name-calling and bullying out there, has been a big piece of this learning curve for me.
Yeah,
so my kindergartner...
That's wonderful, and that's good parenting. Unfortunately, we are just about out of time. We need another hour or two. Listen, by any chance, are you going to be in Philly next Monday?
Not on Monday. Should I be?
Yeah, I was going to invite you. I'm doing a reading here at Barnes and Noble at 6:30, Monday, March 31st, at Barnes and Noble, the one on Rittenhouse Square. I'm going to be reading from my new book, The Wisdom We're Born With. It's along with...
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's along with award-winning poet Ellen Bass. We're going to be doing this gig together. So if you're around, come on out. And if our listeners are around, please come on out. I'd love to see you. Sheila, thank you so much for joining us today. You know I love you and I love your work.
Oh, thank you so much. Hey, me too.
Thanks, Sheila.
I learned something from you, Dan.
Right back at you. All right. Take care of you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about night eating syndrome and obesity. Well, you can download our podcast at whyy.org/voices. Follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Lots of new stuff on my webpage. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.